You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Often discourse around creative products, whether it's art, music, film or fashion, focuses more on the aesthetics or symbolic meaning of a product rather than examining the labour practices that went into producing it. Jessica Hemmings is a textiles writer and professor at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin, and she's currently in the country to deliver lectures on this subject. I spoke to her earlier this morning and started by asking her what she thinks some of the problems are with current models of production.
I think that the biggest pressure is on volume when it comes to production, and that squeezes out a lot of opportunity for creativity. And of course, is also the main reason why we have all of these horror stories about production values, the workplace that so many people work in. The talk that I'm giving focuses on, I suppose, much more creative practices, and I'm incredibly conscious that they hardly provide global solutions, because they tend to be incredibly confined by the scale that they work in. But I think they're really interesting for us to look at, because at least they provide a starting point. They're people that are not being complacent. They're at least not happy with what they're seeing and interested in trying to get us to think differently. Maybe I go to an exhibition which raises these questions and possibly make a different decision later on in the day about what I consume or what I look at as far as a label or information.
And so when I was reading about your talk that you're giving today, a quote that you mentioned from Liza Liu, which really stuck out to me, was about the story and the way things are made is very important. It's part of the meaning. I don't think you can separate the meaning from how things are made. If we do that, then what we do is negate labour and the people that are part of a process. So can you just talk through what that sort of means to you? What does that mean to you?
Well, I suppose I have a soft spot for storytelling. So that's part of my education and my background. I studied textiles, but then I also studied literature. And I think that there's a certain perspective on something like storytelling or fiction, which assumes that it is about entertainment or about something that certainly is at least unreal. And of course, fiction and storytelling allows things to become separated from fact, that is part of how they position themselves. But what I find fascinating is that sometimes is an incredibly empowering position to occupy, to then speak about things that are literal and concrete and factual, rather than dismiss them as that was fiction, that wasn't a newspaper headline, therefore we shouldn't believe it. And our world at the moment and all this dialogue now around post-factual politics and this idea that in a way everything has become a fiction. I suppose, winding back a little bit, I've always been really interested in this idea of these stories that can be sometimes packaged as something that's quite innocent, can often have content in them that is a lot more complex and a lot more critical than initially the first reader would understand. Objects tell stories, and I suppose I use those things interchangeably. An object telling a story, and a piece of fiction communicating in that way as well. The more we know some of that background to things, whether it's real or whether it's created in some type of narrative context, I think the harder it is to then turn off from some of that information we don't want to hear.
Yeah, absolutely.
For instance, why does that object cost what it does? That's wonderful that you can now buy 10 of them. Do you really want to tolerate the story that's behind why that thing costs as little as it does? Or you've had the choice between things rather than maybe confront some of that other information.
Absolutely. So I guess it's kind of examining both the story behind the production as well as just looking at it from a consumption perspective, right?
I think it's also a topic that the media has been playing with for a long time, literally greenwashing and playing with this information. I think there's a fatigue amongst a lot of people that, no, I want to wear a new dress on Friday. I don't give a damn about that information. So we have to find other ways of communicating to people about this. And so sometimes the narrative or trying to, I suppose, make it back to something that's human. And I think that's what Liza Liu is referring to as well. It's a lot harder to then shut down your conscience or pretend that you're not interested if it can get to that human level. And I think storytelling tends to often revolve around that, not just be this big general global blob of something, but this one human experience which can be more powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's like a two-pronged thing though, right? That it's like we perhaps want to not really know, you know, yes. We might not want to know where something comes from, but then that is also like facilitated in the discourse that occurs around a lot of products that get developed, that it's just kind of the discussion about its aesthetic qualities or symbolic meaning or that sort of thing, rather than actually where it comes from. So it's kind of a double-edged thing, right?
And also things can become pretty impractical along the way. So to think that everybody can invest in a T-shirt that costs $200 is, you know, or I think food culture is an enormous example of this, that although people do, I think, inquire a lot more about things, it's not realistic to think that a lot of people can necessarily make those decisions. So it strangely has twisted into something that's quite elitist and inflated along the way as well. The examples that I'll talk about this evening in the talk tend to be people who are trying to understand what those alternatives can be, even though they are very small scale. Or also, for instance, in an example of the wax resist or the batik tradition that we think of as being from what we call Indonesia now, actually Dutch production, which is now manufacturing in the Netherlands, has always manufactured in the Netherlands to sell to the wealth of West and Central Africa. That's not a trade route that we think of at the moment or think of as familiar. That's a real inversion of the stereotype of where we think power and production resides. It's a very small example. I'm not naive. I recognize this isn't somehow suggesting that this is the way the rest of the global market works. But they're very inspiring and they're very poetic things to recognize in a small scale exist and maybe deserve our attention and a little bit of celebration, even if they are very modest in the impact that they're making.
Absolutely. Can you tell me a few more examples from the from that you might be talking about in your talk tonight?
Certainly. There's a project by a South American studio called Hechuzu. They were on the cover of a book called Cultural Threads, which I edited last year. And it's a wooden boat, a canoe. It looks like it's a textile, but it's actually not. It's covered with glass beads, which was something that I enjoyed as the idea of a textile book that actually had an object that wasn't as it appeared, because I think that also plays into a lot of our problems at the moment. The pace that we run through things, look at things, read things, think about things means we're often not even understanding exactly what it is we're seeing or we're talking about. So this canoe, this boat, this sculptural object was sent by this studio to an exhibition that they had in New York City. The family who owned the boat were employed to instead decorate its surface with the beads. The family were subsistence farmers in the very early stages of the drug trade. And the boat, those canoes are now being used to transport goods in the early stages of drugs production, instead of what historically the boat, which would have been used for in the Amazon, which was transport of much more positive things, culture and religion and society and people coming together for things that built a community rather than tore a community apart. So again, this is such a modest example, but the studio employed that family to decorate that boat in arguably a very labor-intensive way to try and disrupt their need for this other income source.
This is obviously an example of a positive alternative mode of production. Mm-hmm. What are some barriers that exist to these flourishing more?
Scale.
Yeah.
So everything, and I'm acutely conscious of this and certainly would take that on the chin as a criticism from anybody who wanted to air it, that these are so modest in the scale. So even that family's employment was a temporary disruption of what they needed. And I think that's continues to be the biggest challenge for people that are trying to create these positive solutions, is the impact for their investment of time and energy and care, the impact that they're making tends to be small. Getting a very large scale textile or fashion company to actually change their production methods is very, very difficult. We think of the textile and fashion industries as places that are constantly hungry for new things and for change, because we're sold this idea that what we're wearing today is going to be out of date and should be changed tomorrow. On that level, it's true, because that's what funds the industries. But actually, as far as change on the bare bones, how things are made and how the industry might operate, they're very risk adverse. there isn't a lot of change. It's a strangely conservative system in that sense. So there are all sorts of really exciting and admirable examples out there, but they tend to operate in quite a limited scale. Now, maybe you could say that that's actually our problem in the present, that I'm even suggesting that that's a negative. Maybe if everyone accepted that we're all responsible for something that's quite modest rather than changing the world, each of us could get on and do something that was really quite useful. You know, maybe we're hung up in this fallacy of we have to come up with ideas or somehow implement things that are so huge. Maybe modest certainly is better than nothing, and I suppose that's why I'm interested in writing and thinking about these things, because they're sincere and they do work, but they work in quite small ways.
Right, exactly. That trying to make this work on a much larger scale, that's when you come up with more and more barriers. Really interesting to try actually make it seem more positive to do it at a smaller scale and trying to encourage people to get involved in those sorts of things on a smaller scale. I think that is really interesting.
Yeah.
So would you like to add anything else? Any other thoughts that you have that you wanted to add?
Maybe some of this also comes down to education. And I suppose because I work in education, I would sort of would lay this challenge at my doorstep as well as everyone else's, that I think that there's a real balancing act in how education approaches a lot of these topics. There's a certain school of thought that would say something like sustainability just has to be a given in every type of conversation or every type of design or artistic education that exists. It shouldn't somehow be a standalone or a separate course. It should be central to everything we do. I met a friend of mine that I studied woven textile design with 20 years ago. He'd spent a lot of time working in India after we graduated and became really interested in sustainability. And I said to him, aren't you angry that we weren't taught these things as undergraduate textile design students? Are you disappointed that we should have been encouraged to think more about it at the beginning of learning how to be designers? And he had exactly the opposite take on it. He said he was so relieved that at that early point in his education, he wasn't yet burdened, challenged with all of those limitations, because it does take a certain amount of experience before you can usefully navigate some of these questions. And so that's an enormous question for education. If at the very beginning of a designer's education, you start to also talk to them about all the limitations of using this material and not using that material, I think you can choke off a type of creativity before it's had any time to build any momentum. So that's a sort of a strange contradiction, that on the one hand, knowledge is always useful, but I think there's also a moment in artistic and design education where somebody has to be allowed to explore and experiment and build some type of experience and expertise, and then maybe start to ask some of those more difficult questions of, gosh, but what if we tried to refine this or that? Doing it at the very first moment of that conversation, I think, can be pretty overwhelming for a creative process. Mm.
Jessica is giving a free lecture tonight at 5:30 p.m. on level 11 of the Sir Paul Reeves building over at the AUT City campus. So head along if you're interested.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.